So I'm Stephanie Geschwind. I will introduce myself in a little bit, but I'd like to begin by thanking David Gibbs from the Council of Literary Magazines and Presses. He's the director of programs for conceiving of this panel, which arose from a virtual conversation several of us literary magazine editors based at colleges or universities had last year. We did one of those Zoom meetings. This arose from a conversation that we were having on our listserv panel. So we found that there was much to say, many questions yet to consider, and a lot of information to share, so we're all here today in person. So let me move along and introduce our panelists. So on the end here, I have Lisa Roney. She's the editor of the Florida Review and author most recently of a new multi-genre textbook, Serious Daring, Creative Writing in Four Genres, which reflects her 20-plus years of respect for the well-done workshop, as well as innovation in the creative writing classroom. She is also the author of The Best Possible Bad Luck, a poetry chapbook, and Sweet Invisible Body, a memoir. Her poetry, short fiction, and creative nonfiction, and cultural criticism have appeared in the Southern Poetry Anthology, Numero 5, Saw a Poem, Inside Higher Ed, Red Rock Review, Writing on the Edge, So to Speak, Sycamore Review, and Harper's, among others. Lisa is also an award-winning teacher with an interest in issues of pedagogy and academic culture. She spearheaded an overhaul of the undergraduate creative writing curriculum at the University of Central Florida, where she is associate professor. With her previous experience as a professional editor, she has developed courses in book editing for writers and advised UCF's undergraduate literary magazine, The Cypress Dome. And next to me is Jody Stanley, director of the creative writing program and editor of Ninth Letter at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She's worked in literary publishing for over 20 years and has been a speaker and panelist at various conferences and festivals, including Breadloaf, AWP, MLA, and the Kenyon Review Literary Festival. In 2009, she was awarded an academic professional award from the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences at her university, and she received a 2007 faculty fellowship from the University of Illinois Academy for Entrepreneurial Leadership. Her fiction, essays, and book reviews have appeared in journals including Mississippi Review, Crab Orchard Review, 580 Split, Cincinnati Review, Future Fire. I never know how to say this. Is it BKMK or is it?
I don't know.
I've always in my mind, it always looks like bookmark. I've always said bookmark. BKMK Quarterly. Does anybody know definitively? Okay. All right. The Smoking Poet, Sycamore Review, Sylvester, and Electric Philosophy. And she has received special mention in the 2004 Year's Best Fantasy and Horror and the 2001 Pushcart Prize. David Lynn has been the editor of the Kenyon Review.
Okay. A million years.
Okay. For a while. An international journal of literature, culture, and the arts. He is just the author of the novel Wrestling with Gabriel, two collections of short stories, Year of Fire and Fortune Telling, and The Hero's Tale, narrators in the early modern novel, a critical study. His stories and essays have appeared in magazines and journals in America, England, India, and Australia. David lives in Gambier, Ohio, with his wife, Wendy Singer, and two children, Aaron and Elizabeth. He is a professor of English at Kenyon College. And I just also wanted to add one little thing. When I was becoming editor of Colorado Review, David was very encouraging, and it's something I have never forgotten. You may, it's many years ago, but you said something really lovely to me that I have always remembered. Thank you. Jennifer Acker is founder and editor-in-chief of The Common. Her debut novel, The Limits of the World, will be published in 2019, along with a nonfiction title. She has an MFA from the Bennington Writing Seminars, and she teaches and directs the Literary Publishing Internship at Amherst College. And I'm Stephanie Geschwind, I'm the director of the Center for Literary Publishing at Colorado State University, where I'm editor-in-chief of Colorado Review. I direct a publishing internship for graduate students, and I'm faculty advisor for the Grey Rock Review, which is the undergrad literary magazine. In addition to curating the Colorado Prize for Poetry books and with Donald Revelle, the Mountain West Poetry Series, I'm also the editor of two anthologies, Man and the Moon, Essays on Fathers and Fatherhood, and Beautiful Flesh, A Body of Essays. And now I have some questions that I would like to begin with, and they'll provide a jumping off point for us. But of course, I'm really interested in opening this up for a discussion. I'm assuming that we have a couple of distinct groups here, people who are currently editing magazines or working at small presses on college and university campuses. So they're already doing this. Can anybody raise their hand if that's true? Okay, so we all have struggles, right? Maybe, you know, this is a good place for us to share some of those struggles, potentially some strategies, take home some ideas for dealing with our institutions. And maybe another group would be people who are at colleges and universities, not currently editing something, but hoping to edit something, hoping to begin something. Okay. Is there a third, fourth, fifth group I'm not thinking of? Okay, probably, but that's all right. Okay, so I am going to start with the question of asking each of the panelists just to discuss what, you know, how is your structure set up for your journal or your press? In particular, are the editors staff, faculty, both, neither? Do you have support staff? How are these operations funded? That's kind of the big question, right? Where's the money coming from? So let's start with Jennifer. Can we just kind of work down? And I suppose if my panelists, if maybe feel like you don't necessarily have something more to add to a question, don't feel obligated to answer if you don't have anything. Okay.
Hi. So very briefly, the Common is set up as a joint venture between the Common Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization that I started when I started the Common magazine, and Amherst College. And what this means in practice is, the situation that we're in now, which is that there are two staff positions that the college pays for. We are staff at Amherst College, and that is myself and the managing editor. And we have a 10-hour-a-week bookkeeper that is a casual position. And we have an annual operating budget that is given to us by the college, which is from a couple of academic departments, as well as the dean's office and the president's office. So these sources sort of cobble together. And then we have the Common Foundation, which is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we do a lot of fundraising. We do, you know, all of our filings for the IRS as a nonprofit. It allows us to apply for outside grants, as well as to fundraise from donors, particularly donors that are not connected to Amherst College in any way.
Hi. I had the great benefit of coming into a situation that was a total disaster. The Tenure Review is celebrating its 80th anniversary this year, but when I took over 25 years ago, it was quite literally really on the hair's breadth of being shut forever for financial reasons. And some of the college trustees stepped in because they thought that would be a really bad thing for Tenure College. And they asked me to take over only because I was the only one around who had any idea of what that meant, although I didn't even know what it meant. And they did then some of the things that Jennifer has now done. We created a 501c3, separated sort of from the college, and flew under the radar for a long time. What we've done is developed a number of different streams of revenue. And we can talk more about that if you wish, but we've grown and we've become much larger. When I took over, there was me, a managing editor, and a part-time secretary. Now we have a full-time staff of 10 or 11, 85 student volunteers, a lot of other people, and a board of trustees, and a diverse, as I said, diverse streams of income. We'll talk more about this if you're interested. I think the key to justifying the existence of a literary magazine, you're never, ever going to convince an administrator of the inherent value of your enterprise. They're simply not built for that. They don't get it. They have no interest in it. They just see it as a drain on resources. Therefore, you have to come up with a strategy for making them believe that what you do strengthens the institution in a meaningful way. And there are lots of ways of doing that, but you've got to make yourself and your organization really essential to the larger program, and I think there are ways of doing that.
Can you hear me? Is that good? Okay, so I am the editor of Ninth Letter, which is at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. We are housed in the creative writing program in the English department in the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. So that's our administrative structure that I'm dealing with. As the editor, I'm an academic professional staff appointment. It used to be a full-time position, and then it went to a part-time position, and I took over the directorship of the creative writing program as the other half of my appointment. I am no longer director of creative writing, so now I'm just a part-time staff member editing Ninth Letter. I am the only permanent staff member for Ninth Letter. We have faculty editors who serve as volunteers. Genre editors, fiction, poetry, and creative nonfiction. Those are creative writing professors who just rotate through those positions every few years. And we have MFA students who serve as editorial assistants and assistant editors and for our print journal. And then we also have an online journal, and that is produced by an undergraduate class under the supervision of a faculty editor. So that's basically how our editorial staff works. We also collaborate with the School of Art and Design. So our design and production work is done by faculty and students in the graphic design department. But in terms of all of the business side of things, business management, and sort of permanent budget management stuff, that's me. That's all on me. Our funding has, for the last 15 years, come from the Office of the Provost at the university. The College of LAS gives us money for graduate assistantships, so they pay for graduate students to work on the journal. But all of my salary and all of our operating funds have come from the Provost. Those funds have been gradually cut every year and will run out in the next fiscal year. And we've been told that they probably won't be renewed. So we're currently in the process of trying to figure out how we can continue to sustain Ninth Letter and where we can get funding from elsewhere on campus to supplement the money that we do bring in ourselves, which we do bring in some funds from grants, donations, and sales, but certainly not enough to continue to fully operate a journal. I'll just leave that there because I'm sure that everything else will come up in questions later. Let's leave you with that cheerful note.
David, I just wanted to be clear whether your position is a staff position or faculty position.
I began as a professor of English in the English department. That's now changed, and I'm officially an administrator. I'm paid out of the administrative budget that is partly collegiate and partly the Kenyon Review.
Okay.
I still teach part-time because I think that's important, but these things do change over time.
Yeah, and I was curious because I'm a tenured faculty member in my department, and the way I'm the one with the handout because, as you can see, it's like I could talk for 3 hours and not fully describe the structure at UCF. And what happened at UCF was some years ago, the course releases that were given to the faculty editor in order to do the significant labor of editing the publication were all withdrawn. And what we came up with as an alternative to that was teaching courses that are related to the Florida Review. Now, this doesn't mean that it's a student-edited journal. It's not. There's slightly different structures for the print journal, which has been around, we're about in our 44th year,
and the new online journal that I created at the suggestion of Jody Stanley when she was my CLMP mentor my first year as editor. And Aquifer, the Florida Review Online, started in, I opened that in 2017, so it's fairly new. And we have two different courses of students every fall and every spring. Now, mind you, UCF is a university with about 60,000 students. I think we're now the second largest university in the country, so we have a lot of bodies, which has its pros and cons, which we can talk about more if people are interested in that. But I teach basically five courses a year, two in the fall, two in the spring, and one in the summer with undergraduates. The university provides me with absolutely no budget except for the GTAs that I have who do the grading for those classes. Not in the summer, I do it all myself in the summer. But I have a part-time GTA for each one of the classes in the fall and the spring. And then I also utilize MFA interns who help the students read and screen submissions. And so particularly with Aquifer, the MFA students and the undergrads do, you know, say no to some manuscripts that I don't ever read, but they don't say yes. So I'm still the person who makes the final decisions about everything that's published. In the print magazine, I have a staff of volunteers, professionals in the field, but none of them earn any salary. They do it out of the love of doing it. I do have somewhat of a high turnover because of that. People do it for a couple of years, and then they put in their time. So I have people who make the final decisions there, and in those courses, the students do read and submit comment sheets about manuscripts, but they don't make any, they don't screen anything out or in by any means. So our funding streams are entirely student and faculty fundraisers, submissions. We do charge for submissions. We get a lot of flack about that, but we wouldn't exist otherwise. There would just be no option. And subscriptions. And so that's primarily where all of our money comes from. We run a very shoestring operation. So for instance, all of our grad students bring magazines in their suitcases to come to AWP because we can't afford the conference services. We lug a lot of books back and forth. I'm trying to think if there's, we did just recently have a wonderful improvement, which is that the dean in the college was convinced to hire a new journals manager for the entire college. We have a College of Arts and Humanities, sciences is separate. We have a number of journals that are published, mostly scholarly journals, that are published out of the college, one in history, one in philosophy. The Faulkner Journal is still published out of the Florida Review, out of UCF. And so this person that they hired is helping all of us with all of our journals. So he provides me with assistance now. This is his first year, and he's been great to help me apply for a few small grants, none of which we've gotten, but we're moving in some of those directions with his assistance. But I don't have any support staff other than that, so it's challenging.
And the Colorado Review Center for Literary Publishing structure is really similar to both Lisa's and Jody's. We belong to the English department. We do not belong to creative writing, but we are obviously most closely aligned with creative writing. 95% of our interns are graduate students in the MFA program, but some of them are in the Tessel Teppel MA program, the Lit or Ret Comp, they're wonderful students, and some of our strongest readers have come out of the non-MFA programs. Which is not to say my MFA students weren't strong; they're wonderful. But so we belong to the English department, and we're part of the College of Liberal Arts. The financial contribution from the institution comes in the form of 85% of my salary. And that's it. Sometimes there's extra funding. The dean has some extra one-time funds, and our dean has been very generous to us. But we are responsible for coming up with the other 15% of my salary, and everything else that we need to spend you know, through subscriptions and single copy sales and individual fundraising, grant writing, submittable reading fees, or submission fees rather, contest submissions. So we cobble together our revenue, or not our revenue, but our, you know, our funding from a variety of sources. I want to say, though, that one of the interests, there are many interesting, maybe interesting quotation marks, things about being at a university, a state university, at least at CSU, we're kind of taxed because we do bring in revenue. Does anybody else have this kind of a structure? Okay, so for every dollar that I spend, not every dollar that I bring in, but every dollar I spend, I give the university 22 cents. Okay. Yeah.
We have 11%, which sounds higher, but
I think ours is 22%.
Ours is 11%.
So, that, you know, I kind of understand it. But
I don't.
It's our custodial services, our security, our lights, our, you know, our utilities, you know, all of that. I mean, that's what happens. So, you know, if you don't have something set up yet, just know that that's a possibility. Probably not maybe at a private college, but probably at a state university that would be true. And then the other thing, and you all will know this if you're at a state university, if you ever get an NEA grant, your university has its hand out for about 36%. And that's really more relevant to those big NSF grants of $14 million for your, you know, biomolecular department. And I do have to, you know, be fair here. I've always gotten a waiver. So my $10,000 and $15,000 NEA grants, the Office of Sponsored Research has always agreed to not take that 36%. So that is one of the things, that is a couple of the things that can happen when you're in university dealing with money. Our next question is, and I wonder if maybe several of you are concerned about, you know, how is your labor evaluated? How does your labor for these magazines? We often talk about labor of love, but how is it evaluated and how is it counted? Is it service? Is it research? Is it both? Is it neither?
So I'm a staff member, and my direct report is actually the college librarian. We are the common, our offices are housed in the library, so it's not a perfect fit, but just sort of, he's the only one around who could do that. And then the next step above him is the dean of faculty, so I sort of report to the two of them. I do occasionally teach for the English department, which is paid on a per course basis, and those get the usual sort of student evaluations, and a faculty member from the English department sits in on my class. But mostly it's the annual performance evaluations and,
yeah. Although the Kenyon Review pays its staff, is responsible for the budget and pays its staff, they're all college, Kenyon College employees. With the benefits and challenges of that, and that includes the annual evaluation process. Although we take it within the review, I spend a lot of time talking about the happy family we are and the positive environment we have. We take evaluations and the other things that make the organization work. We take all that very seriously.
My appointment is academic professional, essentially a staff appointment. I'm not on the tenure track. I don't have to do annual reports. I do teach. I occasionally teach the undergraduate class, and I run the graduate student practicum course, but I don't get paid for teaching. It's just sort of part of my job, and I don't get evaluated on it necessarily. My responsibilities are running Ninth Letter, and that's my job. Our faculty editors, who serve as genre editors, for them that does count towards their service, so they can put that in for their, you know, their tenure reviews, their annual reports and stuff. That counts for service for them. I think that's the only answer I have to that question.
The and this is a huge point of contention for me. In the 45 approximate years that the Florida Review has been in existence and edited by faculty members, not a single one of us has ever gotten full professor. And so that has been a big point of contention. And I also, it's been something that, for me, the Florida Review counts as quote unquote other duties as assigned. And, you know, that means that there is another category, so I'm not being, you know, there's a category in which I can receive a high rating. But it's a point of contention for me that it doesn't count at all as a creative activity. And because I find it to be very intellectually challenging and very artistically challenging as well, creating, you know, themed sections of the magazine, working with writers to develop their work, and it's been, I mean, I don't think any of us would be involved with it if we didn't find it to be a creative and intellectually satisfying activity. And you know, I work at a university where they give degrees in restaurant management, and yet editing a journal counts for basically nothing. And I have found that to be quite an issue for me going forward. I could talk about it endlessly, and I won't do that, but I do think it's probably something that other people here in the room are grappling with, in the sense of, if I do this activity, which I believe deeply benefits the literary community, and I think all of us are shaping the literary world, and yet there's absolutely no recognition of it as an important activity. It's like serving on a committee at best. I find that really, I mean, not that serving on a committee isn't valuable. It can be very valuable. But I had recently asked my department to consider granting some research credit for it. And I, in my email that I drafted to the committee about this, I said, you know, I'm not expecting it to count the same as editing a collection of essays or stories for a press. I mean, it's not the same as that, obviously, but it certainly seems to me that it should carry as much importance as, you know, publishing a book review or giving a conference paper. And they came back with a resounding no. And the logic was quite spurious. It was, we don't want junior faculty members to think that, to get the wrong impression that they might get tenure based on editing a journal. And I was like, well, you know, they don't think they're going to get tenure based on writing book reviews either. And yet that counts as something. And one of the faculty members said, you know, we also had, a couple of years ago, a faculty member had said, well, I think a single poem is as valuable as a story or an essay. And the committee had come back and had said, well, no, because, you know, you can argue in the tenure process or the promotion process that, you know, 6 or 8 essays or stories could comprise a book or be equivalent to a book, but you can't say that about 6 or 8 poems. And I was like, but yeah, but one poem still counts as research. I mean, it's not enough for your whole year's annual evaluation to give you an excellent. So anyway, it was a disappointing thing for me that there was just so little understanding. I feel like there's so little understanding of what we do as opposed to a scholarly editor who sends manuscripts out for review. So
My position is very similar to Jody's in that I'm an administrative professional. I'm 12 month. I'm not on a tenure track. I don't have any service component. I don't advise. I don't have to publish. So I do an annual evaluation that is fairly painless. So I'm feeling pretty lucky about that. But I also, you know, I'm the editor-in-chief, but I'm also the nonfiction editor with Harrison Candelaria Fletcher, who's on faculty. And then we have Matthew Cooperman, Sasha Steenson, and Dan Beachy Quick, and some other, well, Don Rebell at UNLV, And Camille Dungy just came on as a poetry editor. So all of them are faculty, and they get a service credit for editing the magazine. And like Jody's explanation, they cycle through. So it's not a year-long, weekly, monthly commitment for any of them. So the next question is, what are some of the benefits and challenges of working with students, graduate or undergraduate? And here we can talk about internships. And I think that this could be an interesting component just in terms of, of what value is it to the university? Here's where I think a stronger argument can be made for the value of a journal to an institution, and we can all speak to that.
Yeah, so one of my titles is the director of the literary publishing internship, and student. So Amherst College is a purely undergraduate institution, so we have no graduate students. But from the beginning, the college has seen working with students and providing internships to the undergraduates as probably the most important aspect of the journal to them, to the college or university. So that. That is something that we make sure that we do well and that we try to improve on. We have a rigorous selection process and application process for students. It's very hands-on. Students work 10 hours during the week during the semester, and we have 4 of those openings. Sometimes students split internships, so we'll have maybe 6 students working during the semester. We have 3 students working full-time during the summer, and during the January break, usually 2 students working full-time. And a large part of our time, mine and our managing editor, is spent working with students, and they do great work, but they need a lot of training. There is a high turnover with students, of course, too. So the time spent training and the regular turnover is a significant challenge. We describe, we are running a literary enterprise in which our goal is a high quality literary product, but we are also running an educational program in which we are providing sort of, real world and pretty fast paced training. For students. It's valuable for a number of reasons, and I think you can imagine to have these students. The students are paid by the college, so they do not receive course credit, but they receive money, which is a nice incentive for the students. And I would say, we have 2 student interns with us here at the conference, and so I'd be happy to talk more about that. But I think, as David said during his first comment, that you sort of need to find the reason that your magazine is valuable to the institution, and for our institution, it's the student internship program. And so we highlight that when we talk to administrators. We make sure it's going well. We make sure the alumni know about what we're doing with students. And then we say, oh yeah, we're also an award-winning magazine, and we publish these great people, and they say, yeah. But we just sort of put that in there. But that's what's important, and we make sure to do it well.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with what Jennifer has said. The hot word in that world is experiential education. And as I said, we have about 85 student volunteers, we call them Kenyon Review Associates, and 10 or 12 paid interns. We really give them a very intense, worthwhile experience. We train them intensively. We have a weekly seminar for them. They do read submissions for us. They are the first line of reading unsolicited submissions. It takes 2 of them to turn something down, but they do. And the other way of looking at that is that we could not do what we do without them. In a world where we're receiving over 8,000 submissions in a 6-week period, and we are a small college in the middle of nowhere, we couldn't do it without them. But they get a lot in return. A lot of our students are the best students that come to Kenyon. It helps with recruiting students, so you should get the alumni, or the admissions director on board with you. The parents love it, the alumni love it. A lot of these students go on into the publishing world or the writing world or other associated things, but we give them a deeply meaningful experience and they become, again to use that word, they become part of our family, which we take very seriously. In fact, we're having a party later this evening for alumni who are living in this area just to gather them together again and affirm that connection. But Jennifer is right that this is maybe the single most important way of building confidence in your institution, that your magazine is important.
I will second that, or third that, really. I think that that's the most important thing about Colorado Review to our institution. I also believe that literary magazines sort of work as beacons or flags for MFA programs, and I know that a number of students have applied to the MFA program at CSU because they know about Colorado Review first. I know that a lot of times we've had faculty applying for positions, and they often say, I really didn't even know there was an MFA program, but I knew about Colorado Review. I published in Colorado Review. So it's kind of the thing that says, hey, there's something here. So it's, I don't like to really say this, but I mean, it's a kind of marketing tool, really, for an MFA program. So if you're looking for a kind of crass way to emphasize its importance, that's one thing. But the second thing really is the internship. And another bit of kind of current vocabulary besides experiential learning is high impact learning practices. So that's, I think, especially relevant if you have interns who are doing more than just reading submissions, which is great, but our interns do the copy editing, they do the typesetting, they do the cover design, they do the proofreading. So when they come out of the internship, if these are things, and the internship is very self-directed in that way, if you know right now, I don't want to work in publishing, I mean, I don't really care about any of that, I just want to read the manuscripts, that's fine. But I always say, if you are thinking of getting a job in publishing or something related, you really do need to know how a book is made. You need to know the vocabulary. And so I think that is one of the reasons that we are supported to the extent that we are by our college and our department.
Yeah, I think you're probably just going to hear the same thing from all of us. Knight-Butter was founded by the first class of our, at the time, brand new MFA program back in 2003?
Two.
Right. Sorry, we have an alum in the audience who's going to help me out here. that first, when they started the MFA program, that was before I was hired, they knew they wanted to have a literary journal affiliated with it because a literary journal is one of the best ways to get your program noticed, and students will be attracted to the opportunity to work on a journal. When they hired me on, I really wanted to make the journal a teaching journal. I got my start as an editor at the Missouri Review as an undergraduate, where even as an undergraduate under Sarah Morgan's tutelage, we had a lot of involvement in the selection process of the content, which I thought, you know, was a really terrific responsibility to have, and it was a really great way for me to get become aware of how literary publishing worked. I wanted to provide that for our students. So our graduate students do 95% of the manuscript reading for Knight-Butter, and although the faculty, the editors, and myself make the final decisions, all of the final decisions are made with serious student input. Now, the undergraduate portion of Knight-Butter is the online edition, and as I said, that's done as part of an undergraduate course, but it's modeled in a very similar way. They read submissions, they have a very strong voice in the selection of the material for the edition they're working on. And this, in addition to that, we have a graphic design course in the graphic design department where the design students are working with a faculty art director to put together the design of the journal. So all of that allows us to go to the administration and say, we are giving students, all of these students, in two completely separate colleges, in fact, real-world professional experience that they can then take with them and use to get some kind of job placement after. And we have numbers to show that how many students are going into publishing or going on to graduate school and continuing to do work in literary editing. For us, the big key word, at least in the English department lately, and in LAS, has been professionalization. Because students and students' parents want to know that they're going to be able to get a job after they graduate. So what we can provide is some actual physical hands-on experience that they can then put on a resume and take them out into the world. I love working with students. It's one of the reasons why I've been doing this for so long. The real only serious drawback to working with students is the high turnover and the constant having to retrain. It's a little bit better with graduate students because they're there for 3 years, but every semester is a new group of undergraduates, and to spend the first few weeks just even explaining to them what a literary journal is. So, but that's, you know, the balance there is it's much more positive than negative. So.
Common themes. I would say one of the things I really wanted to say is that we have slightly different models. So our undergraduate students are allowed to take the course that we teach, the Florida Review course, twice. And I always tell them, if you really want to get the whole gamut of skills, you have to take both the sections. The one for the online course, where they do spend much more time reading manuscripts, and they don't do as much production. They have a couple of sessions in the office where they crop photos and put stuff up on WordPress. But mostly they spend time reading manuscripts, and the entire second half of the semester we have a weekly editorial meeting. So they winnow, there's four groups of them working with an MFA intern. Each week they read between, you know, 6 and 7, 8, 10 manuscripts, and they choose one that the entire class reads, and then we talk about four every week and pick one, supposedly. And then the other class is much more, the students do read some submissions, but they don't discuss them as much. We only have one real editorial meeting at the end of the term, but they spend a week an hour every week in the office, proofreading, copy editing, and they're just invaluable. I go through everything again after that, but they catch a lot of errors, and, you know, they do a great job with the fact-checking, place names, movie titles, book titles. It's amazing how many author bios, you know, have incorrect publication titles, and so they save me so much time with that. And the turnover's hard, you know, it's starting up again every semester, but we've kind of got it down, I think. You know, we have a very clear program, and it works pretty well to get them trained. So they're invaluable.
I just want to say too that the interns are kind of my favorite part of my job. I love working with the interns, and it's so rewarding when they go away. And if, you know, if they wanted to pursue that track of working in publishing or some kind of publishing related job, there's no better email to get than, hey, I got that job, and I'm so excited.
And I did want to add, that the other thing that's happening with our MFA students, and I don't know how many people here are from universities that have an MFA program, but this has been another administrative point, is that the MFA students who work with the journal have a really great rate of getting into PhD programs. And so we're feeding a lot of MFAs onto PhD programs now, and they have a very, very high acceptance rate.
But getting that email that says I got that job and the experience I had in the internship got me the job, I love that email. It makes me so happy that they're happy and doing something to support themselves. But I do think it's worth pointing out that there is an actual IRS definition of an intern and internship. I mean, you all know this. But what you may not know is that one of the criteria is that an intern will sometimes impede operations. And, you know, that's because you are responsible for we're teaching them something, not just saying, oh, please, you know, re-alphabetize the filing cabinet or sweep this up. I mean, I can't imagine anybody here doesn't know that, but sometimes I do feel a little guilty when all someone is doing is reading submissions, because I just think that's great, but you really need to know how to do this other stuff. Mm-hmm. At any rate, it is about 2:15. This goes until 2:45, is that right? But I'm concerned that we aren't going to get to author questions, and so I think I'm going to cut my prepared questions off here, and maybe they'll come up in the questions from you all. So do you want to start asking questions? Justin, do you have a question?
Yes, hi. So Stephanie, you mentioned that 85% of your salary comes from university, and then you raise the other 15%. Where does the printing costs, where do they come in?
Those come in through the revenues of the occasional NEA grant. I'm not sure that a grant is actually technically revenue, but EBSCO get some royalty, or not royalties, but subscription payments from EBSCO. We get submittable fees. That helps. That also, I really think of the submittable fees though as the pot from which I'm paying my writers. What else? Project News. We get royalties from Project News, and sales of just regular subscriptions, single copies, contest fees. So yeah, that's all coming from those various sources.
And can I ask what the what size print runs do you do?
It'll vary just a little bit, but only by maybe 100 or so. So we're probably printing about 1,250 copies of the print journal. Actually, we don't have it on the journal.
At your various institutions, the administrations, when they are, evaluating the value of the journal, how much is that related to the value of the program it's associated with? Like a creative writing program or an English department or something like that?
We're not part of any particular program. We're not part of the English department. We're not even really part of the library. We're kind of our own department. What we bring, other departments don't care about it. They're evaluated independently, and we're evaluated for what we do.
You're more familiar with how Midletter works, Adam, but we are part of the creative writing program, and one of the biggest selling points for us to the university is the value that we bring to the creative writing program, which already, it existed kind of simultaneously with Knightletter, but the undergraduate creative writing program has been around for over 50 years. And then to the English department at large, the English department itself also sort of counts Knightletter as one of the things it does to raise the profile of the department and the university. The University of Illinois has, in recent years, been putting a lot of lip service to their commitment to arts and the humanities. And we keep reminding them that if you really want to showcase your commitment to arts and the humanities, you ought to support this successful publication that is a very high profile in the world of arts and literature. So, I do know that a lot of journals are not affiliated necessarily with a program. Before here, I was here, I was at New England Review, which was its own, it was not associated with the English department. But especially for journals that are affiliated with MFA programs, I think that they are intertwined. I think for a lot of places, for us, the majority of applicants to our MFA program cite Knightletter as one of the reasons why they're applying to our program, and that means something to the administration, or at least they say it does. So,
If you found yourself with a higher budget, how would you expand your journal?
I'd love to pay my interns.
If your budget had doubled, even, like, would you have?
Yeah, okay.
No, I
don't know. Does anyone have a good?
I do.
I pay writers more. We already put a lot of money into print. And I also think, if you've seen Night Butter, you know that print production is really high quality. But one of the teaching tools that the designers use, that the design faculty uses, is teaching their designers how to make a beautiful product on a tight budget. So I think keeping our print budget on the smaller side is actually good for the curriculum over there. But I would really like to pay writers more.
I would like to pay all of our writers, which we're not able to do. We have recently, through a donor, been able to introduce a small award that one general submissions writer gets every year. So we are working on that, but it's been a real problem for us. But I would also like to pay stipends at least to all the people who volunteer to make this possible. And I would like to be able, in a dream world, I would have a contractual assignment with someone that would say, if you're editor for a year, you get this stipend. If you do this for a year, that would be great.
Definitely, it would be wonderful to pay writers more. We do pay our writers, but I'd love to see them get even more money. Yes.
About paying writers, my institution has told me flat out we will never pay writers because scholarly journals don't pay writers. Mm-hmm. Have you had what kind of negotiations have you had? And when you bring in outside funding, is that a problem for the university?
No, my institution, we've paid the beginning was 1956. I wasn't there. Writers have been paid for a very long time. So that may have been an argument that was had before I ever got there, but nothing has ever, that's all up to me, how I want to spend that money. And no one has ever made that argument. The grant money is, the grant money, the fundraising, the revenue, that's ours to decide how to spend.
I guess I would say in response to that, that it's a bogus question, that scholars are almost all, not all, but almost all, doing their work as part of their educational duties for which they receive a salary. The same is not true for many, many, many artists and writers. This is a small part of their income, and I believe it's a professional activity that deserves to be paid. I think people who perform professionally should be treated as professionals. And that's not always the case, but that's my belief.
I think that this... I think that this is a real problem that we've all faced, is that there's this false equivalency between a literary journal and scholarly journals, and trying to explain to your administration what the difference is for us an ongoing headache. I mean, we never had any problems with people telling us we can't pay our authors. We did have to go through the whole university process of getting a contract that passed through the contracts office, and it's like 1,000 pages long, and it's the bureaucracy is a nightmare. But I think in other ways we've had to sort of fight the same ignorance as to what a journal is and what it does and what it represents that is different from that.
And if I could add to that, just from my own experience, if you can find a donor who says, I'm going to donate this money for your journal to pay writers, they're not going to turn that down. So, even if it's a very modest amount, I have a donor who's now giving me $350 a year to pay writers. And they're not going to say no, you can't do that with the money that the donor specifies that way. So that might be a way to start.
So the other thing that's a little weird about that is that literary journals are kind of a hybrid, right? They're
right.
A scholarly journal for the creative writing faculty. So if you're teaching creative writing at a college or a university that has some kind of expectation of publication, those are the journals that you're publishing in, right? I think that the administration might look at it, so it's just some stories and some poems, but you all know if you're teaching in a creative writing program, that's where you're publishing. You're not publishing in, you know, the equivalent in the economics department, you know, Quarterly Journal of American Economy, you're not publishing there. But what makes us kind of special and different is that we are also publishing people who are not scholars, who don't work at a university at all. And so the Quarterly Journal of American Economics, I don't suspect that there are a lot of economists out there who aren't connected with an institution, who are just, writing because economics is their passion. So it doesn't hold water because we really are kind of a hybrid publication. And this is what I always explain to my institution. So where your faculty in economics are publishing in that journal, my faculty in creative writing are publishing in journals like Colorado Review. So that's I don't know. But and again, we're not only academics. We're publishing people who are not academics. Yes. Do any of us have experience with undergrad publications? And if so, do we have any tips?
I do. I advised our undergraduate student literary magazine at the University of Central Florida. And, you know, I can talk to you afterward briefly between this and my next panel, but in more detail. But, that magazine has been around for about 30 years. And the students basically edit it, but we teach a two-semester class. They have to enroll in a two-semester class to become editors of the undergrad student magazine. And they work with a faculty member, and they also have an MFA student that works with them. And so they collect submissions in the fall and are trained in the fall and discuss the criteria they're going to use. And then in the spring, they go through all the submissions, and then they do the production on the magazine, and they publish once a year. So if you have any more detail later, I'd happy to talk to you.
Another question?
I hope this isn't too long a question, but I edit a journal, and I'm in kind of the state of Ninth Letter in that we were forced to be self-funded through contests. That's how we started. Now the college says we can't do contests. I get one course release out of six to be editor-in-chief. That's my compensation. And so really, they're putting so little into it. And we're doing international content. We're doing really amazing stuff. So I'm actually meeting with my dean when I get home to try to convince them that they really need to start putting something into this. And you've given me great ideas, so thank you. But I also wanted to ask, is there like any one thing more that you'd recommend for somebody in my position?
Well, again, I think it's the student.
Okay, yeah.
Do you have an internship?
We do. We don't call them that, but yeah. And we actually only have one partially paid student position, and the rest are volunteers. But they do get a course credit.
So that might be the direction that you want to consider, is formalizing it as an internship that you're getting credit for.
And if you have enough
grades for,
if you have enough students to make a class, I would recommend making it a class, which will then help you because it can be one of the classes that you teach.
It is informally a class. I mean, they get a couple of credits.
But you don't get teaching credit for it.
No.
Yeah. So if you have enough students, I don't know what your class size has to be, but if your department will approve a course with 10 or 15 students and you have enough students that would fill it, then you could at least do that once a year and have them, and then you would be able to pick the ones that were the best so for the next semester, you know what I mean? And
are you working with graduate students?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
think that's probably going to be your best argument.
Yeah, but the dean would have to come forward with money to fund that course. And yeah, it just becomes this kind of chicken and egg situation.
Right.
But thank you. That's something to propose.
Another question?
Yes, please. This is kind of a unique situation. There is a poetry center there's a poetry center that's affiliated with my college. They run a literary journal separate than the English department. So we're kind of in competition with that. So that we've had no real journal in our English department for, I don't know, 15, 20 years. I have run a very small student journal. Want to expand that. Do you have any tips for convincing administration? You know, we need to kind of expand. I'm just center is not interested in getting student involvement. We have no students involved. Nothing on that end.
The center that's encouraging.
It's like affiliated with the college, but it's a separate entity. So it has no core, our students aren't involved, our English faculty aren't involved. But I have a hard time getting support for our department in expanding our own smaller department.
I think it's the same suggestion that you propose it as an experience for your students, but as an opportunity for your students, and that you need a journal to give them a certain kind of internship experience. And you don't talk about what you publish or why that's important. You focus it on the educational aspects.
I'd also strongly recommend you do it on the cheap. Do an online journal, which is not expensive to produce, especially if you've got the labor to do it. So I would start on the cheap.
Thank you.
If I had to start a journal tomorrow, it would be online. Yeah. Especially if I had no support. Yes.
Hi. Thanks. This has been super helpful. My name is Jill. I'm on the call today. And we have just adopted a literary magazine, River Teeth, after 20 years of publication. So we are giving River Teeth a new home, and the way we convinced our administration to give us the support that we needed, or some of the support that we needed, was exactly what you're saying, David, about how saying we can give the students these opportunities, transferable skills, all of these things. But one of the things we proposed, this is a two-part question. I don't know very much, and so I'm probably going to be bothering you all individually, so thank you in advance. B, you mentioned, David, other things that would convince the university that it strengthens the institution in a meaningful way. So I'd like to know if there are any that you didn't mention yet that you could still mention.
Actually, just as you were saying that, I was thinking of this. One of the things that we began on a very small scale and is now around much larger is what we call the KR Reading Series. And we have a reading basically once a week. And instead of doing it at the traditional hour in the evening, which adults don't want to stay around for, and students have their own things to do, we do it at 4:10 in the afternoon, which means that adults, it's easier for them to come, it's easier for the students to participate, and it's also really good for building community relations. So if, this is another way of showing the value of what you're doing is, as a literary journal, having a reading series that reaches into the community, that involves students, faculty, and local people, is not expensive, but it builds lots of goodwill and it's very visible.
You might guess what I'm about to say, but one of the things that has made Ninth Letter very attractive to the university historically has been the collaboration between the creative writing program and the School of Art and Design. The university was all about that cross-campus collaboration. They thought that was amazing. So if there's any way that you can get an arts program or some other programs on campus to be connected to or involved in the River Teeth project in some way, I think that's a big selling point.
Just one more.
When I created Aquifer, our online magazine, in 2017, I knew right away I needed more quote-unquote stakeholders. And so one of the things that I did was I recruited a film professor, an art history professor, and a digital media professor. And they each edit a section of Aquifer, so we now are an interdisciplinary arts magazine. So we feature short experimental films, digital stories, and electronic narratives, and we feature visual arts portfolios as well. And they just do their thing. I mean, that has become so easy once I recruited them. I don't know what would happen if any of them quit. But it's that the dean loved that. It's the interdisciplinary buzzword, and he, you know, he was really happy that we have this, and then more people are involved, and more students in more departments.
Part B? You have Part B?
Well, then I feel selfish, but... So this would be helpful for other people also. We're calling it the River Teeth Literary Learning Lab, right? And so we're gonna be doing like push-ins into other, we have a large English department creative writing program into classes that don't necessarily have experiential learning already. So it's kind of this new model that I'm developing where, say, I would come into your class, Jody, if you were teaching creative nonfiction and do something for 2 weeks that would have a River Teeth component, right? And you would do like, so if anybody has any thoughts about that, this is an idea that I have that seems to be working, but I haven't actually developed these pods yet. That's really, really specific question, but I guess the question then would be like, what sorts of things do you think that that students can participate in kind of quickly and still get something out of?
I don't know, but I like that idea.
I do too. I'm gonna think about that and steal it.
I give freely and take freely.
Yes.
So, you know,
yes.
If I were going to do it, Jennifer, go ahead.
I was just going to say that the easiest short-term thing is an editorial workshop where you're workshopping a submission, and then that's where you can teach real editorial skills, and you can, you know, depends on how hands-on you want to be, but you can do copy editing and proofreading and talk a little bit about, you know, how the editorial process down the line. But that doesn't require skills coming in. It doesn't require training on particular software.
Right.
It depends on, you know, how techy you want to be. But there are more technical software things that you could do too. But if this is more liberal artsy critical thinking skills, then workshopping, you know, a short story, an essay, and a poem over the course of 2 weeks, and having students do mock edits, writing letters to the editorial, letters to the author, that kind of thing.
I think we have a question. Yeah, one more question.
Yeah, I'm curious about the equity issue of unpaid internships.
Mm-hmm.
I teach at a two-year college, and even offering course credit, because we have a course attached to the magazine, because it's not satisfying any requirements, a lot of students aren't interested in taking it just as an elective. So I'm just curious if you have any ideas about how to address that issue.
How to address the issue of equity, are you saying that they're not taking it because it's unpaid labor?
Yeah.
So they're not seeing the value of the experience.
Well, also that they have to
pay.
To take the
mm-hmm.
course, and,
yeah.
and if it's not satisfying a requirement, it's not worth
it. You're right. It's a tricky situation. At CSU, and I'm sure this is true of most, you know, colleges and universities, by the time you have hit, say, 9 credits, you're a full-time student, so it really doesn't cost you anymore to take that internship. And you're, depending on the program, there may be an internship component that's required, or at least those internship credits count toward graduation as, you know, part of your just general basket of electives. So, I think it just kind of depends on how you look at it. For the students who achieve 9 credits or more, they're not really paying for those internship credits. I guess you have to decide which credits were above the 9 and which credits were below the 9. Does anyone have a better? Yeah. I mean, there's just no substitute for that experience, though. To be able to leave your degree and say, I worked at X magazine, and I can do this, this, and this. I know how a book is made. I know how to run a magazine. I understand how to, run a website for something. I don't know how else to make that argument if that's not convincing enough.
Yeah, and I don't know what your curriculum is like exactly, but one of the other possible avenues would be to talk about getting it to count as a particular kind of elective in your program. So that would be a, you know, a faculty level, administrative level method of going.
Yeah, the undergraduate ninth letter class is a 400 level class, and the undergraduate creative writing majors are required to take two 400 level creative writing courses as part of their major. Many of them just take two 400 level workshops, but they have the option of taking a 400 level workshop and then taking the ninth letter publishing course instead. So it can fulfill a requirement for them. So if you can kind of finesse it, you could make that work.
We are out of time. Thank you so much. And I think we'll be here for a couple more minutes.